Please rise.
Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Monsanto Company and others versus Cornerstone's Municipal Utility District. Justices Doggett and Enoch are recused in this case.
May it please the court, Mr. John L. Hill, Jr. will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please this honorable court, Your Honor, it's our position here that municipal utility districts, so-called MUDs, are not immune from the statute of limitations under the statute which we display here on this board and one in question in this case. If the MUD attested, it's our position that if they fail to file suit for damages on time and depend on this statute for relief from their neglect, they are barred from recovery, just like you and I would be. They occupy no special status as far as the statute of limitations is concerned by virtue of this statutory provision. They're not mentioned in the statute, and they don't fall under it in our view. We ask here simply for a plain language reading of the statute and to follow the well-known principles of statutory construction. I'm very reluctant to ever say to the learned judges here what those principles are. Forgive me for just a very quick reference. Where a statute is unambiguous, the court must apply it literally, express enumerations of things as equivalent to exclusion of others. Interpretation by implication is not permitted to contradict or add to a statute. Courts must take statutes as they find them. Courts are not responsible for purported omissions in legislation. Where the legislature has intended to refer to political subdivision, it has done so expressly. That last is not a principle of construction. That was a statement that I have to have written down on this same sheet. Their own expert legal counsel, Vincent and Elkins, told them that they were subject to limitations way back in May of 1987. Their recorded minutes show that they were told that the limitations period ensuing over their sewer system problems had begun to run. Finally, on August 17, 1987, Vincent and Elkins, according to the minutes, told the board it had, quote, until June 1989 to file suit. And despite this repeated advice from probably the most recognized municipal law firm, or at least one of the best ones in the state, the district delayed filing the lawsuit until July 13, 1989, well after the limitations period applicable to its claim had run. So they hardly qualify, Your Honors, as a sympathetic plaintiff. And bear in mind, a MUD is pretty local in its operation. Its business is conducted, as we all know, in a non-bureaucratic, engineers and lawyers across the table, around the coffee pot atmosphere. And there's no big public policy reason for giving such an entity and the folks they represent extra protection against things dropping through the cracks that can sometimes happen in a large bureaucratic atmosphere. They just flat didn't attend the business. And now they're asking to be bailed out under a suggested strained statutory interpretation that would require this court to violate really every known statutory interpretation principle to help them. And if they want to avoid this in the future, and I personally, if it's a personal observation, don't particularly see any great justification based on public policy even for that, to give them such a special status, but if they get it, it should come from the legislature, the lawmakers, and not from this court. And you have often reminded us in your writings, this court sits to interpret statutes, not to invent them. So let us just look at the plain language of the statute. It's up before us. A right of action of this state, a county, an incorporated city or town, or a school district is not barred by any of the following sections.
Judge Hill,
yes, sir.
Their argument is they're neither a state, they're not a county, they're not incorporated city or town or school district, therefore this statute does not apply. Mm-hmm. What is your answer?
Well, our answer to that is that as you know, the 16061 is the successor statute to former Article 5517. We can't find any help there in following their analysis because really 5517 limited the exemption to the state. The 1953 amendment added counties, cities, and school districts. So how can that help us? Well, it specifically, it seems to me, enumerates the particular groups, the cities and the counties, that are to be included and have the benefit. And if the state was to be taken as including all other political subdivisions, there would have been no need for the 1953 amendment adding the counties and the cities and the school districts. And under prior case law, the political subdivision analysis had only been used in tort immunity cases. It had never been used to construe a statute. This is a statutory interpretation case. It's not a case where we've properly reached the right answer by saying, well, it's a political subdivision, although very low in ranking, but it still can be cranked in under the phrase, this state. This state refers, as the case law shows, to the state, its departments, its agencies. A statewide jurisdiction, in one case Texas A&M, is covered, but not a political subdivision of this right. That would just virtually make the statute, if you include the word this state to go that far, you've just opened up Pandora's box. It is the floodgate down as to what that would mean in terms of the results in this case. We've got many other statutes which specifically use the words and other political subdivisions. Many of them. We have other statutes that specifically mention Article 16 of subdivisions, such as this. The legislature knows how to put these political subdivisions into some statutory mold if they want to. And the fact that they didn't do it here, that's even more proof that they didn't intend for them to enjoy this special statute. When they codified 5517 in 1985 with the 16061, it was brought forward as a non-substantive codification. And then in 1989, the statute was again worked on to add these 16001, 16004, and all of these statute of limitations to make it clear which ones were covered. And this court wrote about that in City of Fort Worth, construing versus Johnson, construing this very statute that's before you. And they were asking this court then to add to the scope of 16061 by adding the statute of repose under Section 16008. Course, is not that. And you held per curiam in that case that you were not authorized to do that. It would be left up to the legislature to add the repose statute if he wanted to. And we just suggest that this is as Judge Robertson used to say, a simple little statutory interpretation case. And that we need to look at the statute and interpret the statute. You did it at Johnson, we ask you just to do it again. It's a statutory interpretation case, in our opinion. Yes, Your Honor.
If it would be a statutory interpretation if a municipal utility district was a political subdivision, but Can you address why it is a political federation rather than an agency?
That is very well covered. There is one case that we have, the guarantee government case. I can see if I can find it. I think, Your Honor, if you'll let me work through for just a moment, I will get to that, if you please. It is a question that I can answer and I want to answer, but I need to have a little bit of backdrop for it before I do it, if I might, please, sir. The court has also literally construed substantially similar language and other limitation provisions. Irrigation district, they ask you to add that to the state or any county, city, or town, and that was refused. And the irrigation districts, of course, are created under these same articles. We have that case set out, the Ward case, in our brief. I know you don't like to have cases read to you, but sustaining this view, we call attention to the fact that had the words either to the state or any county, city, or town been omitted from this statute, the article would have had exactly the effect intended by the irrigation company. If then any effect is to be given these words, it must be that they limit the exemption to do the state, county, cities, and towns. The same conclusion was reached in the Rutledge case, which we cite and discuss, involving Levy Improvement District. The same was reached in the state of for Dallas County, Boise, Dark Island Levy District. And you repeatedly and emphatically found that districts created under Article 16, Section 59 of the Texas Constitution that do not come within these statutes, which exempt the state, county, cities and towns from limitations. You had another case, City of Port Arthur versus Tillman. You said in the opinion, when the petitioner city formally annexed the water district and became subrogated to its rights, only some 10 months of the limitation period had run against the water district. You said there it had run against the water district. And Article 5517 applied to the petitioner at that time, and the 2-year statute of limitations does not apply. So if water districts had been immune from limitations pursuant to Article 5517, the court would not have had to reason or consider whether limitations had run against it. Now then, a literal construction is dictated because at common law, the mud districts, of course they didn't come into existence until 1971, were not immune at common law. There's not any case holding that a mud district is immune under a statutory interpretation or any other kind of interpretation from limitations. The cases that have been written, Your Honors, have largely been in these immunity from torts situation. I think that's where that they went wrong in the Lewis Cox case. And I think you'll obviously have to deal with Lewis Cox case because it goes off on the same thing that the Court of Appeals here did and which your question is asking about. Well, if it's a political subdivision, where does it slot in? It slots in, Your Honor, not with the state, because of the case law, that guarantee case, and I still haven't found it in my notes. I'll get back to it in just a moment. But state government is generally defined in terms of the executive, legislative, and or judicial branches, and does not include political subdivision, not having statewide jurisdiction, as illustrated in over 40 statutes that we cite in our appendix. A political subdivision differs from a department, board, or agency of the state. A political subdivision has jurisdiction over a portion of the state. A department, board, or agency of the state exercises this jurisdiction throughout the state. Members of the governing body of a political subdivision are elected in local elections and are appointed by locally elected officials. Those who govern departments, boards, or agencies of the state are elected in statewide elections and are appointed by state officials. Political subdivisions have the power to assess and collect taxes. Departments, boards, and agencies do not have that power. Our examination of a number of statutes show that the legislature has consistently recognized these distinctions between departments, boards, and agencies on the one hand, and political subdivisions on the other, and I'm quoting from Guaranty Petroleum Company versus Armstrong. That has been the consistent analysis that has been applied in connection with statutory interpretation. It's so easy for the legislature, if they want to add anybody in that they think is entitled to some favored status in the law. But we'd be straining ourselves to say, well, the legislature didn't do it here. They could have easily done it. They've done it in a lot of other instances. We're reminded by case law that this is not a state agency. It doesn't have statewide jurisdiction, but we're just going to wrap it in because it is a political subdivision that has some governmental function. There's no question about that. I question whether here what they were doing and putting in a sewer system is governmental or proprietary, but I don't think we have to go down that road. I think it just muddles the water to start down this distinction between governmental and proprietary. When did the counties become eligible for immunity from tort? Were they eligible just for governmental functions or proprietary functions? All of that is wrapped in to the analysis that Judge Drawn made in what we believe is his erroneous writing in this case is unnecessary. That we shouldn't be lost in that jungle. We can win in that jungle because they didn't have common law immunity. And the emphasis that common law was on sovereignty. Was on sovereignty. Kind of hard for me sometimes to get that one. But it goes on sovereignty, the analysis of the state versus local. That was the Bennett analysis. Though that's the Hatcher analysis. Those are the analysis that we think are the proper analysis for a case like this. And we cite all of that in our brief. Because Texas
common,
am I, my time's up now, is that right?
Your time was, if you wish to use further time, it would be taken from me.
I'll reserve. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please support Mr. Richard Warren, Midoff, will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, I represent Cornerstone Municipal Utility District. It is our position in this case that this municipal utility district, as a political subdivision of the state acting substantially in behalf of the state, is entitled to immunity under the limitations section 16061. In analyzing this statute, we have suggested two issues that need to be resolved. First, whether a municipal utility district is a political subdivision of the state, and if so, whether the word state as used in this statute includes political subdivisions acting substantially on behalf of the state. With respect to the first issue, we suggest there is very little dispute but that a municipal utility district is a political subdivision of the state. First, the Texas Water Code defines the word district as including a municipal utility district and includes, quote, any other district or political subdivision of the state. Secondly, the case law.
Counsel, though, when the legislature wrote 16.061, they put political subdivisions in there. A county is a political subdivision of the state, isn't it?
It is, and that is addressed in our second issue, which I will move to now to answer the question. The
I keep jumping ahead of it.
You weren't giving a script. I'll move to that, if I might, when I come to the second issue, if Your Honor would indulge me. With respect again to the first issue, the case law supports the proposition that a municipal utility district is a political subdivision of the state. The Village of Lakeway case decided by the Austin Court in 1983, the Brubaker case decided by the Houston Court in 1991, both so hold. And third and finally, the constitutional authority that creates the conservation and reclamation districts, including the statutory equivalent, now called a municipal utility district, specifically provides that the state itself, quote, may be divided into, unquote, such districts as may be appropriate. With respect to the second issue, the issue raised by Your Honor, and that is whether or not state in this section includes political subdivisions acting substantially in behalf of the state, we have two cases directly in point. The Lewis Cox case involving an underground water conservation district and the Capitol Rod and Gun case involving a river authority, both of which clearly hold that a political subdivision acting substantially in behalf of the state is included within the definition of state in section 16061. We are aware of no case holding to the contrary under this section. We are aware of no case overruling either Lewis Cox or Capitol Rod and Gun. Indeed, Lewis Cox was cited by this court with approval just a few months ago in the case of State of Texas against Durham, in which this court cited that case for the proposition that, quote, the state in its sovereign position, unlike ordinary litigants, is not subject to the defenses of limitations, latches, or estoppel. Now, the petitioner's argument, which Your Honor raises, is that the word counties would not have been added in the 1953 amendments if political subdivisions such as counties were already included within the definition of state. In order to understand, we suggest, the formulation of that statute and the history of that statute and the interpretation of the word state, we have to look to the common law history that preceded the enactment of that statute. Obviously, the best evidence of what the legislature meant would be some legislative history. There is no legislative history that we are aware of. The next best evidence, we suggest, of what the legislature meant is found in the common law history that preceded the enactment of that statute, as well as the common law history that followed. And a review of that history clearly indicates that by common law, limitations does not run against the state and does not run against the political subdivisions of the state acting substantially in behalf of the state or exercising governmental authority on behalf of the state. And this same common law immunity exempted counties when acting in a governmental capacity in behalf of the state. This is the area discussed in the Delta County against Blackburn case, the Supreme Court case of 1906, and the Jackson against Nacogdoches County case, the Dallas Court case decided in 1945. This common law history is set out in our brief and is set out extensively in the Southwestern Bell amicus brief, in which they trace this same history even more extensively than we set out in our brief. If, in fact, the counties had this immunity at common law acting in behalf of the state, why then the amendment? The most reasonable explanation we suggest, given this history, is to extend immunity to the counties not only when they are acting in behalf of the state, but when acting in their own behalf, so that now counties enjoy broader immunity than they would have under the common law because they are protected both when acting substantially in behalf of the state and when acting in their own behalf. That, we suggest, is the most reasonable explanation for why the legislature added that amendment. If you go back...
This distinction was drawn in the preceding cases. It's your position. The distinction between a county acting on behalf of the state and on behalf of itself.
Yes, Your Honor. The Delta County case in particular, the Jackson against Nacogdoches County case in particular, and there are other cases, a number of which are cited in our brief and in the Southwestern Bell brief, in which it is clear that the court struggled prior to this time deciding whether the county was acting on its own behalf or whether it was acting in behalf of the state. And the county would win if it was found to be acting on behalf of the state, but lose when it was not. Now, whether this immunity is denied to a political subdivision of the state if acting in a purely proprietary capacity, as suggested by Southwestern Bell in its amicus brief, is an issue that we would suggest does not have to be decided by this court in order to affirm the Court of Appeals here, because we believe there is no dispute in the record but that this municipal utility district was acting in a governmental capacity and substantially in behalf of the state. I say that for three reasons. First of all, the Court of Appeals below noted at least three times in its opinion that this municipal utility district was performing, quote, government functions, unquote. And that finding has never been challenged, to our knowledge, by petitioners in this proceeding at any stage. Secondly, the Brubaker case, the Houston Court of Appeals case decided in 1991, clearly holds that a municipal utility district is a political subdivision of the state and, quote, operates as a governmental agency performing governmental functions, end of quote. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, this court in Bennett against Brown in 1954 held that Article 16, Section 59 entities, and this is one of them, are, quote, entirely governmental in function. That holding was recently reaffirmed by this court just 7 months ago in Guillory against the Port of Houston Authority, where this court said, quote, in Bennett, we held that governmental units created under Article 16, Section 59 of the Texas Constitution are entirely governmental in function. Water improvement districts and other agencies created under this constitutional provision are different from municipalities in that the former are created by the legislature for general purposes, while the latter are created by the consent of their inhabitants. The impact here and the potential impact on the state is clear. A municipal utility district under the Water Code is specifically charged with protecting the sanitary condition of water, quote, within the state, unquote, and specifically charged with preserving the natural resources, quote, of the state, unquote. If a municipal utility district falls into bankruptcy by virtue of not being able to afford the repairs in construction and maintenance of the sanitary sewer system, it falls within the jurisdiction of the state's Water Commission. With respect to counsel's argument regarding the Ward and Rutledge and Glenn cases, where counsel referred to a certain rejection of exemptions, all three of those cases are delinquent tax collection cases decided under a delinquent tax statute exemption, and they were not decided under Section 16061, and we would respectfully suggest have no relevance to this issue. With respect to Tillman, the Supreme Court case cited by counsel and decided in 1965, the only issue there, we submit, was whether the city, by segregating the rights of the water district, could invoke Section 16061. This court held that the city was entitled to assert immunity. It did not hold that the water district could not assert that immunity. Indeed, it could be argued from that case that the city as subrogor was entitled and limited to the rights of the water district as subrogee, and if the water district could not assert that limitation, then the city could not either. The stakes here, we suggest, are very important. If this political subdivision of the state acting substantially in behalf of the state, and those are key words, does not have the immunity which we suggest political subdivision acting substantially on behalf of the state have always enjoyed, then the financial burden here will fall on the taxpayers, or ultimately, if the taxpayers are unable to bear that burden, on the Texas Water Commission, which has jurisdiction over the bankruptcy of municipal utility districts. So the potential here is great, and the potential impact on the state great, and we respectfully suggest that the Court of Appeals was correct and should be affirmed.
Counsel for the appellant tells us that the Municipal Utility District was advised that the limitations were running by other counsel. Was that just erroneous advice?
We believe it was erroneous advice. And I have not gone into the facts because I don't think they pertain to the narrow issue of limitations, but indeed, there was discussion back and forth in the record between council and the district about what to do. The problem was first thought to be a local problem involving a point failure of a particular section, not a system-wide failure, and council were negotiating with board members and board members with the engineer in an effort to fix a point failure. there was substantial evidence, in fact, that the district was led along and strung along by the engineer, believing it was a point failure and not a system-wide failure. There's also evidence in the record, since Your Honor raised it, of a document from one of the defendants in which it was decided, quote, to stonewall this situation, unquote, rather than advise water districts about the defective pipe and defective resin that was being supplied for that pipe. There are a lot of facts that come to bear and that were discussed ultimately in this meeting. But in our view, yes, the original advice by counsel was erroneous.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I'm going to have to kind of skip quickly. We do not dispute that a MUD is a political subdivision. That's a straw man. Durham was a rape judicata case stating the state in its sovereign capacity is not subject to the defenses of limitations. You are all familiar with the case. It's not too old. I don't have to tell you it doesn't control this case, the statutory interpretation. The case referred to by county being on the same, the district being on the same footing as county, dealt with tort immunities. I've already tried to say that you're going to have to work through those cases where there's some language about the counties and subdivisions. You'll find them in tort immunity cases. You will not find them in statutory interpretation situation. Now, our reply to Lewis Cox is that it involved the enforcement of a water conservation district's order. It was not a suit for damages. It's in this case. I don't say that's the only reason to disavow it. It is a reason. In concluding that enforcement of the order was not subject to limitations pursuant to 5517, the Amarillo Court of Appeals ignored the language, did not refer to the statute in the terms that we are talking about, and nothing about any rules of statutory construction, didn't refer to the Brazos River Authority opinion at all. It just applied the common law analysis of proprietary versus governmental function. And if you do that, you come out sometimes with a different answer. If this court does that, you may or may not come out with a different answer. I don't think so here because I don't think it was governmental. But that's not the way, in our opinion, to approach the case. The Amarillo Court's interpretation, or we think misinterpretation, of 5517 was criticized in the City of El Paso case. It's all in our brief. There, the court recognized that this common law proprietary versus governmental distinction had no application in Article 5517 analysis, particularly in light of this court's language in the City of Port Arthur versus Tillman. They spoke of Lewis Cox's analysis of 5517 as, quote, obiter dictum, and did not view it as controlling law. Now, this is in your court. This is what Supreme Court's here for, when the differences exist between the way courts below and the courts of appeals have looked at the statutory interpretation or any other field of the law. If not reversed here, the Court of Appeals decision below will dictate that municipal utility districts are not only exempt from limitations, which they never were. I don't know where my distinguished colleague got the statement that MUDs have always enjoyed immunity from limitation. I don't know from whence this comes. Certainly didn't enjoy it at common law. We say they don't enjoy it through any statutory interpretation, and no case has said yet that they do. They're asking you to say that in this case under this statute. And if you do that, you're defining the rights of the state, not just MUDs. The consequences of such an approach would obviously be far-reaching. He talks about far-reaching. It would be impossible to predict how far such a ruling would go in terms of with so many quasi-municipal districts and other political subdivisions. Now, where does it all end if all you're going to say is that under a statute that says this state, we're going to include all these others lower political subdivisions in? And I don't mean to degenerate what they're doing. They're doing governmental work. They're doing good work. They didn't do very good here about tending to their business about filing this lawsuit. But I'm not trying to put them down. I'm trying to say I don't want the state muddled up under this statute where everything that anybody wants to claim as a political subdivision for whatever purpose can come in whenever time the legislature uses the word this state. The legislature uses political subdivisions a lot in other statutes, in other contexts. They know how to do that. If they want this relief, they should go to the legislature and get it where a fair public policy debate can take place. I'll close on public policy. Statutes of limitation are generally regarded with favor by the courts. We're not here trying to cloak something with some sort of a technicality. They're to be construed like any other statute, and their application is not to be evaded by implied exception. We cite cases on all of these statements I'm making. Exemptions from limitations not only lessens the accuracy of adjudication, it presents considerable potential for abuse. This district would have this court abandon these public policies in favor of a result-oriented approach that protects them from their own neglect. Not only is that approach without authority, it is, in our humble judgment, without equity. Unlike ordinary citizens and entities who are subject to the statute of limitations, whether or not they're apprised of them, the district has the benefit of expert legal and engineering advice at every step of the way. Its ongoing awareness of its sewer system problems was carefully noted and preserved for posterity in the board minutes. The board was advised repeatedly of the need to take action within an applicable limitations period. Compliance would have produced no hardship for the district, but would have aided its efforts. Had counsel's advice been followed, this entire proceeding would have been unnecessary. Filed suit some 10 years after work on its sewer system was begun. It now seems to be rewarded for its efforts by being granted favored status, which the legislature has bestowed sparingly and did not intend for it to have. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the third cause. The court will now take a brief recess and will come back to hear arguments in Prudential Insurance Company of America versus Jefferson Associates Limited.
Audience, please rise.